You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Tana French has written three best-selling and award-winning police procedural novels, and she has twice been a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Award for Best Mystery Thriller. Her fourth novel, Broken Harbor, returns to Dublin and that city's elite murder squad. It's published by Viking, and I'm pleased that it brings Tana French to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're known for chain-linking your books, where a secondary character from the previous novel narrates the next one. The narrator of this novel, Broken Harbor, is Detective Mick Kennedy, who was Frank Mackey's nemesis in your last book. How long after you introduced him in Faithful Place did you know that Kennedy was going to be your next narrator?
Well, not till I'd finished Faithful Place and was working on Broken Harbor. I had originally planned for another secondary character to be the narrator of this, but as I started working on Broken Harbor, I realized this is about people who have tried all their lives to follow the rules, to do things right, to do things the way you're supposed to do, and what happens when the rules turn around and kick you in the teeth, basically. And Mick Kennedy had all through Faithful Place been presented as a very rule-bound, pompous git, basically. And it became obvious that this story, which was all about following the rules, was a story for him, who's all about that very same thing.
Well, you also have to choose a narrator you're willing to live with for a while, because you're going to be in that person's head while you're writing the book. It's even different than writing third person.
Yeah, it is. And I'm coming from an acting background, so first person is a lot like being in character for a show. I was worried about this one because, again, in Faithful Place, Scorcher was not presented as a particularly sympathetic character, but then that's because that's what the narrator needed to see.
That's his nickname, Scorcher.
Yes.
How did he get the name?
Well, that depends on which book, which narrator you believe. The story's in his favor in his book. He claims it's because he scored a scorcher of a goal in a soccer match, whereas in Faithful Place, Frank is claiming that he gave him the nickname to take him down a peg or two. And that's one of the reasons I like chain-linking narrators, is you get to show how what one person sees in another may be what they need to see rather than what the person sees in themselves.
Well, once a character becomes a narrator and you're developing him further, have you ever regretted how you'd written about him previously when he was just a secondary character?
No, because that's kind of your very basic blueprint that you go on when you're fleshing out the character. If something doesn't quite gel with the way you're thinking of the character, then it means you need to go back and match it up. There's always a reason for something.
You mentioned that you come from an acting background. You were 34 when you published your first novel. But had you always wanted to write?
Yeah, I did as a kid. But then that kind of went by the wayside when the acting kicked in. It's very much the same thing. And to write and act at the same time would be like playing two characters at once, you know, one in the matinee, one in the evening show. I think it would get very confusing. So they don't really... they're not simultaneous things for me. And when the acting kicked in, when I was a teenager, the writing kind of disappeared up until I had the idea for In the Woods and wanted to see where that would go.
You create flawed heroes with often devastating histories, the kinds of people we often find in plays. The Greek tragedies, for example. I don't know whether that was in your mind when you started doing this.
Well, I think everybody, to be honest, is more interested in characters who are damaged in some way. Because let's face it, by the time you get to your mid-20s, the likelihood is very high that you have been damaged in some way, that you're struggling in this form of damage. And I think we are fascinated by seeing other people try and struggle to find ways to either confront or suppress or assimilate or move through whatever damage has been done to them, because we're all struggling too.
Now, I've read that the great majority of your readers are women, despite the fact that three of your four narrators have been men. Is that rare?
Huh, I didn't know that. I think overall the majority of psychological mystery readers do tend to be women. I'm not sure why. The male narrators just happened. That wasn't a plan. It wasn't a deliberate crisscross. It's just that's how they popped up in my head.
Because you have written a female narrator.
Yes.
You could have written more.
Yeah, and... the general plan is that I will at some point.
When you were acting, did you ever want to get into the mind of a male character?
I have done. I've played a 10-year-old boy, among other things, when I was very definitely not either a boy or 10. I don't think that's the big leap for an actor, male to female. I think it's more of a leap for me writing narrators who are so badly broken when I'm not. Like, that's a much bigger imaginative leap.
Now, in this book, your villains are rather unconventional compared to... your previous mysteries and what we usually expect. Was this based on your reading of the newspapers?
Well, somebody pointed out to me that this is a book with no villain in some way. Every single character in the book is trying their best and is doing what they do out of love, no matter how twisted it may be. But definitely, the atmosphere in Ireland soaked into this book. I didn't set out to write a kind of state of the nation type book. That's not what my intention was. But if you're living in Ireland today, what's been happening, these ghost estates, half abandoned, half built, full of people who can't get out now because they're in so much negative equity, this is in the air. It's hit everybody in one way or another. And it's hit my generation, the 30-somethings. We're the ones who got sucked in to a large extent. It haunted me.
So the real estate bubble, there you are. Your books have all had some kind of topicality.
Yeah, it links in. Again, what's in the air? I think if you're writing crime, it seeps in more, because any kind of crime novel is always about the fears of a certain society, the priorities, the tensions within that society. You write about murder. Murder is a universal crime, but it's shaped by time and place.
So are there real criminals involved? We're talking about financiers, real estate promoters, politicians who pressured young Irish families to embrace the property boom. But is that illegal?
Oh, well, the reasons they were doing it are very definitely illegal. There was a lot of corruption involved in how the property bubble was built up, and it was essentially a pyramid scheme.
Have any of those responsible for the real estate boom and bust in Ireland been held accountable? Has anybody gone to jail? In this country, there have been many calls for prosecutions, but nobody really has been indicted.
Yeah, here neither. It really, really hasn't happened. Very slowly, we're starting to try and have some kind of accountability. But there's something in the Irish psyche that I wonder if it has to do with so much colonization. We have a very hard time with the concept of the powerful being held accountable.
My guest is Tana French, whose latest novel is Broken Harbor. It's published by Viking. There's another elusive villain in the book, a dangerous animal. That is in the family attic of the Spain family, but only Pat Spain can hear it. So you also wanted to explore the idea of a character's psychological unraveling?
This is something that somebody pointed out to me actually after I had finished the book, when it was basically ready for publication, that this is a book about madness, that all of the characters are in one way or another either unraveling or fragile to begin with mentally. They're trying to hold on to a sense of reality that's slippery and slithering. And Pat Spain in particular is a guy who has always had an easy time with reality. They've got on very well, he and the life around him. And then slowly, as he loses his job, his house starts to crumble, his mind starts to crumble around the edges too. And he starts hearing, whether it's real or not isn't clear, but something is inside the walls of his house.
Well, I'm wondering about the mental stability of people in Ireland. Or are they just...
Overall,
is this
on a
just
Saturday
a problem
night?
For characters you invent for your books?
Well, I think on a national level, actually, there was a serious push towards a kind of madness. Because obviously, writing about this book, I thought about it a lot. And what seems to be at the root of a lot of mental fragility is a disconnect between inner and outer reality. And we were being urged to believe in this property bubble. Just if you believe in it hard enough, then the reality doesn't matter. If you believe in it, it'll keep going. Like, reality was irrelevant and it was unpatriotic.
Have you had any experience with this kind of mental instability?
I've been very lucky.
I don't mean you personally.
No, around me, it hasn't played a large part in my life. I've been lucky.
Because troubled childhoods have been a recurring theme of yours since your first book, and that usually leads to problems later.
Yeah, no, I didn't have a troubled childhood either. I was boringly happy, actually.
You were pregnant while you were writing your third book?
Yes, Faithful Place.
So did you produce the child and the book around the same time?
Bless her. What a great kid. She waited until 10 days after I had handed in the manuscript.
Barbara Kingsolver talks about knowing that she had until childbirth to complete her first novel. And she
I wrote
did it
fast.
Right on deadline.
Yeah, me too. I wrote fast.
So does being a mother, has that changed at all the way you approach writing?
Oh, big time. I've got a routine now. I used to be completely nocturnal. I'd be up until 4 in the morning writing, sleep until noon, get up. Not anymore. Now at whatever, 8 o'clock in the morning, something is shouting into the monitor. You get up and you get working. I'm much more organized.
Your books deal with the friction between the past and modern society and with Ireland's struggles. So I mentioned earlier that there's a topicality to all the books. Is that something that's in your mind, or is that just are you just struck by something you've been reading in the newspapers and think, gee, you know, there's a story to be told here?
No, it's never something out of the newspapers. It's always, I think mystery writers are people who are always looking for a potential mystery in everything. And every one of my books has come about that way, where something relatively normal happens. And I'm going, how could that be something mysterious?
Mm-hmm. Well, in one of the books, we have an archaeological dig, which, of course, is another sort of a mystery-solving problem.
Yeah, it's a dig, just like a detective peeling back the layers to find out where this originated.
Your knowledge of police procedures is impressive. Did you hang out with the cops for a while to get it?
I'm lucky. I know a retired detective who, bless him, will answer so many questions. I ring him up and ask him the weirdest questions, and he's like, yeah, no problem. And here's a couple of stories about what it's like to be a detective thrown in. And that's what answers the questions I didn't even know how to ask. Like, what does it feel like to be on a case that's not going right? What does it feel like to be in an incident room when the pressure is on and you have to charge or release the guy? He's great.
And also working with cops who you don't like.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of tension as well when there's pressure to solve a case and the person you're working with on your team is somebody you really dislike.
Really dislike or really have a moral conflict with as well, because these are people who deal with big moral issues every day on a very practical level. And I'm not sure they necessarily are thinking about the meaning of right, wrong, truth and justice, but they're dealing with it in concrete terms. In the action, you know, the suspect isn't telling you the truth. Do you lie to him? Do you threaten him? Do you hint at threatening him? What do you do? And they're dealing with these on a concrete level every day, and I think that ups the stakes.
Should I assume that you've started working on your next book?
Yes, I'm about, touch wood, I'm about halfway through it. Otherwise, it's going to be even longer than the other four.
So can you tell us who the narrator is?
This time it's Stephen, who was going to be the narrator of Broken Harbor until that became obvious that it wasn't right. He was a minor character in Faithful Place in my third book. And he, another minor character, the narrator's daughter, Holly, shows up. She's 16 now. She's going to a girls' school. And in the school, there's a notice board on which the girls can anonymously reveal secrets like, oh, I really like so-and-so, or I hate my mother, or whatever, you know. And a card, Holly has found a card on this board that has a photograph of a teenage boy who was murdered on the grounds last year, and the caption, I know who killed him, and she brings it in to Stephen.
Tana French is the author of bestsellers In the Woods and Faithful Place. Her latest is called Broken Harbor, and it is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.